Today at Reader's Corner, Melissa Colasanti, author of the new novel, Call Me Elizabeth Lark. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, novelist Melissa Colasanti joins us to talk about her debut novel, Call Me Elizabeth Lark. 20 years ago, Myra Barclay's daughter disappeared from the rocky beach across from the family inn off the Oregon coast. Ever since, Myra has waited for her child to come home. One rainy afternoon, the miracle happens. Her missing daughter, now 28 years old with a child of her own, walks in the door. But the reunion isn't so simple. Elizabeth Lark is on the run, wanted after killing her abusive husband. Melissa Colasanti's writing has appeared in Lit Hub, Memoir Magazine, The Coffin Bell Journal, and others. She holds a BFA in fiction from Boise State University, that's the Bachelor of Fine Arts, and is the Stephen R. Custer Scholar in Creative Writing for 2019. Call Me Elizabeth Lark is her first suspense novel. Melissa Colasanti, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, how are you?
Great. It's great to hear you again. We had a chance to have dinner when Boise State was celebrating scholarships and fellowships and the students who won them. And I guess to help our listeners understand why I mentioned that word Custer with a different first name, Stephen R. Custer was my son who was an aspiring writer. But as you know from our conversations, he passed away of cancer years ago. My wife and I established a scholarship program for him with the help of family and friends all over. And that's what funded your creative writing scholarship and your bachelor's degree in fine arts. So just to get that aside so our listeners will know what that's all about. The first thing I want to do is congratulate you on the book's success. And by that I mean not just the fact that I read it and loved it and loved what one reviewer said from the New York Journal of Books, brace yourself for a never-saw-it-coming ending. Man, he hit the nail on the head. It is indeed a never-saw-it-coming ending. But back to the congratulatory note, you had this book published in New York City by Crooked Lane Books. I'd like you to tell us about that publisher. That's quite an accomplishment. How does this happen? I assume an agent may have had something to do with it, but what's the process? How's this work?
Yeah, she did. I have a wonderful agent. Her name's Lauren, and she's also from New York with Triada, which is a really, really good, was just absolutely thrilling part of my journey as an author. And then, I have a wonderful editor at Crooked Lane, and her name is Jenny Chen, and she fell in love with this book and helped me revise it, lots of revising to get it to a level that I'm proud of.
You know, you gave credit to a long list of authors who critiqued your work, and that's not uncommon. That happens with every book that somebody puts in their hands. But as I read your list, I thought, wow, if I was an author and I had written this, there'd be some trepidation handing it over to people, some of whom I may know well, some of whom I may not know well. It's kind of exposes you to them and certainly exposes your writing to them. Did you ever have any of those moments when you're thinking, you know, well, I wonder what they're going to think of it, and do I really want to share this with anyone? Maybe that's what writers have to do, and that's the end of it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's always such a vulnerable experience, and I think even more so letting it go to, you know, my agent and editor, but then the biggest is readers, because it's out there and it's finished.
Yeah.
As far as critique partners, I know some from Boise State that I fully trust, and then some that I've met online in different creative writing groups that I love all these people. But of course, when you put your book in their hands, especially earlier drafts, and you know, you're going to get so much critique and criticism. But I have to say that getting my BFA at Boise State, and I so appreciate you. You are a big part of the reason that I was able to get published, because, you know, that just, it was amazing. Not only getting the financial support, but just getting into the writing community in Boise was just amazing. And as far as critique partners, you know, you're going to start getting like really hard critique that you have to, you know, go through and see, but it is, and see what you're going to change. But it is kind of a precursor to the publication process because it's even more there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're super nice, but at the same time, it's like, we're going to take this to a level that's going to be, you know, publishable, and that's going to have the kind of things, especially with suspense, that readers expect. Mm-hmm. Because there's a literary fiction element to this book, but also people want, you know, plot.
Well, hey, I want to mention that and the literary fiction part, because this is not the kind of book that comes out every year and is written by the thriller writer and is all about plot, and it's fast-paced. It is about plot and it is fast-paced, but it is literary, and by that I mean the evocative language you use to describe the setting of this novel. I want to talk to you more about that later, but I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the very second chapter, and I just have to read this for listeners so they have some idea of how beautifully this is written. You're talking about a cabin where something happens. The cabin is situated in a thicket of deep wood where lime green lichen weeps from the trees like gnome hats. Tufts of moss unfurl through the walls where the wood has rotted, while the foundation crumbles precariously beneath their feet. It is as tiny as a dollhouse dropped amid the lush, expansive forest, surrounded by frozen creeks and giant boulders. You're not going to find that in one of those annual thrillers that come flying out. And so, clearly, you really got a lot out of that Bachelor of Fine Arts, and you obviously have native talent that has a lot to do with this. You mentioned all these folks who were so helpful. Any Boise State faculty that you could mention that actually gave you a little help on this one?
Well, this is really interesting because this was actually sort of made of two short stories combined. Uh-huh. That I wrote in intermediate fiction with Natalie Disney from Boise State. And it began, there were two different stories. One was about Myra and the imposter walking into the inn. And the other was about a woman who was escaping her abusive husband by killing him and running away. And then for the novel, the idea was to intertwine the two. But like the first and second chapter, at least the beginnings of each of those are very similar to the short stories.
Interesting. So I was going to ask you that, where this idea comes from. I was reading a book the other day called Falling, and I don't remember the author, but she's she was an airline flight attendant, and she said she wrote the book in the back of the plane on long trips from New York to L.A., and that's where she got the whole idea of the book. It's really about an airline disaster of some sorts. And so I was going to ask you, you know, like, where do you get an idea for a book like this? So it comes out of these two short stories. Cool.
Yeah, two short stories. And then I got, at first I was like, let's make this very suspenseful. And I think that it is still, but I also realized that I needed these characters, and you needed it to be character driven because of the premise that I chose, where we have this missing girl and she, you know, this mother, and it's just, I would not have done it justice, I think, if I just went hard with only, you know, the suspense aspect, I think. So right. I realized I had this very intense premise that I wanted to do justice.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Melissa Colasanti, author of the new novel, Call Me Elizabeth Lark. So we've given our listeners a look at who you are as the writer, so let's get into the plot. Why don't we begin with Charlotte and Myra? But we'll start with Charlotte. What happens to Charlotte? And then you can move from there into the rest of her mother's life, basically. And we'll go from there. We'll get into Elizabeth after that.
Sure. Okay. So in the beginning of the novel, there's sort of a, this has happened after 20 years prior, she had lost her youngest daughter on the beach. And what happened was her sister was supposed to be babysitting. And so she took her down to the beach, teenage party type of thing, and her sister went missing. So I think those two characters are dealing with not only the loss of this little girl, but also the guilt involved with Gwen, the sister, her extreme lifelong guilt about having lost her sister, but also her mother maybe not 100% forgiving her for that. So the two of them have a difficult, complicated relationship.
And you know, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, hey, this happens, not a lot, but this happens in families. There are tragedies where somebody carries the tragedy with them for the rest of their life. There are tragedies where a husband blames a wife, a wife blames a husband, and you're working their way through this is somewhere near therapeutic. I know you didn't write a therapeutic novel, but for people who wonder, you know, what do you read this novel for besides the suspense and the beautiful writing? It really is also an eye-opener. It's a look inside a family, and while your family may be fictional, there's so many of them which are not.
Yeah, it's devastating, really. And that was the part where I realized I had to get deep into those people.
So along comes Elizabeth Clark. After all these years that Myra is waiting around for her daughter to appear, in walks Elizabeth Clark. So tell us about her.
Elizabeth is also, you know, she's a traumatized person. She had been up in this cabin with her son held there by an abusive husband, and she escapes and goes towards her home and ends up stopping at this inn. Myra does mistake her for her daughter, though, and it's probably important to know, and it's really right in the very beginning, that Elizabeth is feels very guilty about this and just kind of has not a lot of options. And she's kind of thinking, well, you know, I have a warm bed here and I don't want to break this woman's heart who really truly believes, you know, and that's right from the beginning. And there are moments where I think she's trying to get out of it, but doesn't. She's an imposter, but sort of on accident, if that makes.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think you leave the reader in a suspenseful position. I mean, it's as I was reading it, I'm not so sure I even was sure what was going on here. You know, is Myra right? Is the mother right that this is in fact her daughter? I mean, you point out that her eyes are blue, right? And that was the color of Charlotte's eyes. Is that correct?
Yeah. And honestly, that would be the one thing I was thinking about this and doing some research on people who, you know, this kind of thing has happened. And it's like, if her eyes were not the same color, there would be no story, because it would be obvious from the start that she couldn't mistake or she couldn't come home if she had a different color eyes. Right. So that was kind of what I focused on in terms of the appearance that Myra gravitates to.
Yeah.
It's her daughter's eyes.
So Elizabeth has a girlfriend, and that's probably not the right way to say it, but Alice I'm talking about. And you can tell us about Alice, but Alice does seem to be this confidant that Elizabeth can rely on, who turns out to be very helpful in this encounter.
Yeah, she's the woman who has the safe house for, you know, abusive or abused spouses or partners, and she helps her with the escape, though Elizabeth doesn't quite follow all of her advice. She ends up being, I would say, a very important help to Elizabeth.
No question about
that. Thinking of ways to say this without giving away the plot too much, but yeah.
Well, after the moment of truth is revealed in a rather violent scene at the end of the book, your third-person narrative comments, women, we save ourselves and we save one another. And you just mentioned where Alice comes from and what she's doing in this novel. Is that a strong theme for you in this? I mean, it definitely is a strong theme in this book. But I just wonder, when you set out to write this book, okay, it's going to be suspenseful, but was it also your intention to deal with this issue?
I think it, yeah, for sure. I always tend to write about relationships, usually like between mothers and daughters, I wouldn't say that's in every book, but I aim to look at women helping each other, because there's so much out there where, you know, women become kind of pitted against each other. And I wanted to show a situation where we can uplift each other. And so I think that is a pretty common theme in what I write.
Well, I don't want to leave, I'll leave some people out of our conversation of the novel, but I want to talk about Myra's other kids. And you mentioned Gwen and this difficult relationship over the years between the mother and the daughter, because Gwen really senses that the mother never got over this and blames her for Charlotte getting away that night. There's also Jimmy.
Yes.
And you've got a quote in there from Jimmy that certainly suggests he spent too much of his life listening to stories of Charlotte.
Yeah, and I think Jimmy, because he was born shortly after this tragedy, he kind of did not get the attention from Myra that he craved. And I think all three of these women characters are reacting to trauma in their own ways. I like Gwen, she's a fighter, and Elizabeth, she's fleeing her circumstances, and Myra is frozen. So since she is frozen, she has not shown to other children as much love that she actually feels, but that she's just stuck. And I do believe Jimmy felt that. Gwen was a little bit wrapped up in feeling guilty, so she was kind of accepting that, but she was frozen, and that is one of her biggest life regrets through the book and through her character arc, really, too. What is this fact that she was stuck on Charlotte going missing?
So Theo is Elizabeth's son, a young son. Tell us a little bit about how you developed him as a character and how you decide on what age he should be in this.
I wanted him to be fairly young because first of all, Elizabeth isn't, you know, she's fairly young too. But I wanted him to be fairly young because he has an ability to kind of bounce from this. And I feel like young children have a better ability to do that than as we get older. And he kind of bounces back from this and is able to live with Myra and at the inn and throughout the story more, like he's able to accept this more than Elizabeth. She's more pulled down by trauma. And also I think he's kind of the one character that's a little bit more, I don't know, I don't want to use the word fun, but he's got some joy to him, and I didn't want this whole thing to be extremely, I mean, it's dark, but I wanted there to be some joy, some moments of up.
He's also a smart kid.
He's very smart. Yeah. I wanted him to be kind of precocious too.
Yeah.
He's actually helping his mother in this situation as well.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Melissa Colasanti, author of the new novel, Call Me Elizabeth Lark. Well, you know, as I'm reading this, and especially that passage that I read earlier, I've spent quite a bit of time in the Cannon Beach area of Oregon, and both on the beach and in the forest hiking, and also in Puget Sound. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, Melissa had to grow up there or spend a lot of time there, because this sounds exactly like the place I used to or occasionally hang out. Does this go back to your upbringing? And were you raised in that area, or did you just decide to use this?
I moved there right after my first husband passed away, and I had two toddlers, and we lived there for nearly a decade. And to me, I usually set my books here. In fact, my next focused out here too, in off the Washington coast, though, in a little island. However, I love the area. It has soul, in my opinion. And so it's kind of, in some ways, a love letter to the Pacific Northwest for what it did for me in a period of grief, and also just because I feel like it's almost alive with nature.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to ask you a much more personal question, but you've been blessed with spouses who have had a considerable impact on your life and your career. And you mentioned this in your acknowledgments, or I wouldn't bring it up, but it's in print. Maybe you could share that with our listeners, because these novels, why they have one person's name on them, have a lot of people's names on them after that, right?
Absolutely. My first husband, I think, with his passing away and having to, you know, raise two kids for a time on my own, gave me a more sense of humanity, I think. And then my husband, Anthony, is absolutely wonderful. We have six children, and he has, really, these books are written because of him. I mean, I would not have the time with, I just graduated school and then completing these and doing the revisions and stuff, if he was not a very, very good father. He is a very good father and extremely loving and cares about what I do. And because of that, I'm able to write. And he keeps me not as stressed too, because he doesn't feel like, he feels like fathering is the same as mothering. And a lot of times you don't get that with being married. So I'm extremely lucky and fortunate and blessed in that.
So you mentioned writing. I've talked to so many novelists who explain the way they go about it, and not just novelists, those who write nonfiction as well. And some are absolutely disciplined. 6 a.m., I'm up writing, and I write till noon, and I'm done for the day, and I'm back at it the next day at 6. And then there's others who, like I mentioned, the author of that novel, Falling, who catches it on her flights from New York to L.A. What's your secret formula for success here? How does this work for Melissa Colasanti?
So I think it's kind of a combination, because I do have certain goals that I want to achieve. Like if I'm thinking, I want to write 1,000 words a day when I'm drafting, or I want to spend 2 hours a day revising. But it works better for me to take like sprints writing rather than to sit there for many hours, especially given the busyness of my life. I can do pretty well on drafting if I do 30 minutes to an hour increments or little sprints in writing. And I manage to do my goals that way. Currently, because of the pandemic, we don't have childcare. So it's the two of us working from home with six kids. Two of them are teenagers, but still the other ones are young and they're extremely loud. I need quiet. So I usually go to the library for maybe 2 hours a day and get, I mean, a considerable amount done considering what else I have going on. And I usually feel more fulfilled when I get that done. So I'm kind of both. Like I'll try to sit down if I have a minute. I guess that's a parenting issue too. Like I wrote a lot of scenes in the pickup line at, you know, elementary schools and on my phone. I mean, you know, there, or sometimes I get like a burst of creative thought after I go running. So I would sit down at the gym. Now I'm working out at home, but I would sit down at the gym and put out a scene on there. But I also want to have my couple of hours a day set there so that I can get something done.
So when you add it all up, how long does it take? Does it take a year or 2 years, or what's the time frame for this book, for example?
This book was interesting because I wrote the first draft in 3 or 4 months. And I usually can do that in general, just because, you know, wow, if you did 1,000 words a day, you need a novel to be about 80,000 words. But I do spend a couple of months, even maybe 2 or 3 months, figuring out my characters and getting to know who I'm writing prior, because that is very important for me to know before I even go into it. I'll write scenes just, for example, to develop them. But once I start drafting, I mean, I'm not too slow on that. But revision takes a really long time if you want to hone that and get it, you know, as perfect as you can. So when I sold, when we sold this book, it had taken a year. And then it was another year before it came out, revising with my editor and then doing the few, you know, there's always a line edit and then there's like three past pages. So, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it, copy editors and things like that. So I think I wrote the, finished the first draft of this in July 2019, but I started it in 2018, like I said, in Natalie Disney's class.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
So I've listened to so many authors tell me how they wound up where they end up at the conclusion of their book. And some say that they literally plot it out at the beginning with a whiteboard or some kind of an outline where they know exactly where this is going. And then others say, hey, the characters have to take me there. Your novel is... like I said earlier, it's complicated, and like that reviewer said, brace yourself for a never-saw-it-coming ending. I guess the question I have for you is, did you see the ending coming at the beginning, or did you let your characters help you figure this out as you're writing the book?
So I think this is why it took so much revision, because initially a big chunk of that twist at the end was not originally in my first draft. I did, it's kind of hard to say because I will attempt to plot it out, but then sometimes that, like, I'm writing a draft right now and suddenly I'll be in the middle of a scene and decide, wow, they are taking me a different direction. But now being published and having an agent who likes to kind of know the direction and likes us to go back and forth and brainstorm, which is amazing to have. But I do a little more planning because we want certain deadlines to be met and things like that. However, still, even right now, I'm at the halfway point drafting, and all of a sudden my characters are like, wait a minute, we're not writing full suspense here. We're writing a little bit of, you know, general fiction or humor to these, you know, in this as well. So I go, and now I'm going to go and replot the end. And it helps me sometimes to stop in the middle and do that versus just continue plowing through and then having to completely change it when I revise it. But this book, I revised it completely several times, even after I'd started querying it. Initially, it was there was less twists and plot. And some of that my editor helped me come up with. So I have to give other people credit because it does take so many people that are behind the scenes to complete a book.
But, you know, that's an interesting point that I never really focused on before, that your first novel could possibly be the toughest because when you're writing that first draft, you don't have an agent or you don't have an editor hanging around. I mean, you may have some friends, you may have some people in the BFA program, but you don't have the people that are going to put this thing to print helping you out. But once you go through that first book and learn from them, then you can anticipate for the book you're working on now, for example, you can anticipate where they're coming from. And that may make the task of writing and rewriting a bit easier, huh?
I think it's also a little easier because before you get an agent, a publisher, let's just say when you're originally querying a book and you have your letter, you have your first 10 pages, and even if they love the first 10 pages, they will ask for the full manuscript. But if you haven't captured it the way that they want, then you would get a rejection on that. And in my life, I have gotten many, many rejections. But now I'm able to send a draft prior to her sending it out to editors or anything else to an agent who very much knows what the industry is going to like. Like, for example, I'm working on a new thing and she's like, let's add a prologue. Well, I wouldn't have thought to do that. And just having the support of that is very different than when you're on your own, just sending out, not really quite knowing what people are looking for.
Very impressive. Well, We've taken so much time talking about this book. I just want once again to share with our listeners what I thought of it. I was just stunned when I opened up. To be honest about it, I was on Amazon. I was looking for a good read, and somehow your book came up. It's not like I found your name first. Oh, yeah, I'll look up Melissa's name because I had dinner with her at a Boise State function. I just opened up Amazon, and there you were. And it was just so impressive. I don't use Kindle a lot, but I do occasionally use Kindle. I buy most of my books from Rediscovered Books and Barnes & Noble, but I just had to get into it immediately. And I did so with Kindle, and it was consumed in a short period of time. And I think what makes this book so special, in my way of thinking, is the extraordinary writing. I mean, you're just such a good writer, and you have every right to call this thing a literary thriller. And secondly, the whodunit or the what happened, whatever you want to call it, this is clearly a book where you spend many pages trying to figure it out, and I guarantee our listeners they won't. And that's what makes it so perfect. So, Melissa,
thank you so much.
Yeah, that is just, I want to thank you for joining us today and having this conversation. And to our listeners, get out and get a copy of Call Me Elizabeth Lark, a novel by Melissa Colasanti. Thanks for being with us, Melissa.
Thank you.
Reader's Quarter is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. Don't forget, Reader's Corner is also a podcast, easily obtained on your computer or your mobile device of choice. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.